Okay, Dan's gone.
He's given up.
Dan left.
We were just chatting away too long. He's given up.
He said, carry on. Yeah, he just was like, but he said not to leave, didn't he? Because otherwise the recording
doesn't
go.
Should we stop the recording, though, and then it will...
No, I don't know. Well, hang on.
Well,
he
is still in the room. Oh, I can see there's a fourth person. He's just switched his camera off. He says, no!
Hang on. Hold tight. Yes,
hold on tight. No, yes.
There you go. That's clear as day. Rabbiting on. Rabbiting on.
It's unbelievable. They've led us back. It's season two of Rabbiting On, and I'm Rabbi Debbie Young Summers.
I'm Rabbi Miriam Berger.
And I'm Rabbi Robin Ashworth-Steen.
And for anyone joining us for the first time, a very, very warm welcome to Rabbiting On. So let's introduce Rabbiting On for those who might be listening for the first time. What's your favourite thing about season one of Rabbiting On?
I just loved in the first series being able to chat with you two. It's just been like, I've just loved it. It's been a great highlight of my week. And I think with also having like now started to travel around, go to London a little bit and meeting congregants more as they come back to shul, people listen and it's really helpful. And I know that some people have had, for example, around fasting on Yom Kippur, a couple of people got in touch to say how helpful it was for them and they're not able to fast, for example, with disordered eating or eating disorders. And someone's written a beautiful blog about it and said that our podcast was really helpful. Things like that, you think, amazing that we can have these conversations that are shared with others and we get to talk about them with people as well.
Except so it feels like a, yeah, I always forget that these conversations are shared with others. So then people quote them back at me and I'm like, how do you know that? I was just talking to Debbie and Robin. I forget. But that's what my husband, Johnny, always says. Listening to the podcast is like having you over for dinner, but he can't get word in edgeways. So I always think that's,
and
that
food's
sums
rubbish.
It up.
Yeah.
He's used to that.
Yeah, I have to. I think, you know, we're all a little bit exhausted as we come together this morning. We've just finished the High Holy Days. But actually knowing I was starting off today with this crew was just so uplifting. And we do forget, I think, that there are listeners. But then we get all this feedback and people write in. And it's so wonderful when we hear from our listeners and kind of learn about how it's impacted you or what else you'd like us to cover. So welcome and welcome back if you're here again. We are just really looking forward to being together again.
It's been a long time.
It has been. When was the last episode?
May. It's been like the whole spring, summer.
Oh, wow.
High Holy Days. That's a long time. We've done a lot.
If you have suggestions for what you'd like us to have a think about, we love hearing from you. And we do have some exciting news coming up, don't we? What are we doing this series that we haven't done before?
Drum roll. Miriam doesn't look sure.
I realise I'm excited.
Yeah. We're going live. We're doing a live recording of the podcast on December the 1st, which I'm really excited about, with real people in a real room having a proper chat. It's going to be great. And we're inviting back some guests and it'll just be a great celebration, won't it? I still find, and I don't know about you for the High Holy Days, a great sense of blessing of when loads of people together. I'm still in pandemic mode. So when I take a moment, I'm like, oh my gosh, we're all in a room together. And I think it's going to be a bit like that on the 1st of December, particularly because we're only usually in this little space with us, that to be in a big space, it's going to just feel really fun, I think, and completely nerve-wracking, I reckon. I don't know.
What were your High Holy Day highlights?
It's been an amazing journey. And there's the kind of the big highlights, the massive community moments. So we're really thinking about that piece of what does this High Holy Days need? So, you know, 2 years ago, what we realized it needed was a safe way of people having their moment of being in community. And so we did the drive-in Rosh Hashanah service. And then last year we were like, what does it need? We need to be outside so that we can all be together, but as safe as possible. And so we were outside in a rugby stadium. And so there was a lot of conversation before this High Holy Days about like, what will people need? And what we realized was that kind of healing moment of what do you do with taking the kind of anxiety of I'm back and I'm in a room with all these hundreds of people and you know, what does it mean to feel both the sense of joy and the sense of sadness of those people who are not back in the room and the anxiety that's still around? And so to be able to kind of hold those two very different feelings. And so Cantor Zoe and Gareth Malone, the choir master extraordinaire, wrote a piece of music weaving two texts together that kind of held those two different voices. And Gareth kind of turned the community into a choir of 1,300 people in this kind of moment, both on Rosh Hashanah morning and again with the Torah out around the whole community on Simchat Torah. And so we kind of bookended the High Holy Days with these big moments to sort of hold 2022, I think, is a High Holy Days, again, different to all others. And hopefully by next year, we'll slot into a new normal. But I think that it needed kind of its time to be able to say, this, you know, you can't just go into normal and think everything's fine again.
Definitely think Miriam should have gone last. It's kind of like hard to follow. Sorry. With Gareth Malone leading 1,300 people up in Manchester in a smaller community. Yeah, it sounds amazing though. I would love to, I want to see the recording of this one actually. It'd be great to hear. Great, I'll have a look. Yeah, so in we're about to, if anyone's heard this for the last 20 years, move from our building in Manchester. It's been a story for 20 years. We were actually moving, our office are moving this week, and we're moving in, our last service is the end of November in our building. So a lot of what we were doing was talking about endings, which works really well actually in the way that you were talking about, Miriam, of that kind of transitionary period that we're in or have come to the end of, I'm not sure. So it's a lot about beginnings involving endings, that they have to have an ending as part of it. Beginnings are hard. So having a bit of time for grieving, but also a bit of a time for looking forward. I have two moments that came to mind when you asked what my High Holy Days highlights were, which is hard to say quick. So first of all, on Simchat Torah, lots of firsts, and especially women having first moments religiously. So one of our members put on a tallit for the first time. So she tried it the night before when she carried a scroll. She said, "Should I wear one?" I said, "It'd be great if you could." And she put one on, and then the next day decided to wear it for the whole service. And we said the Shehechianu blessing together on the bimah, and everyone sort of heard and joined in. And that was like joyous. And, you know, what I want to be doing in the world is letting people have meaningful experiences with rituals and things. And then the second one, my favorite, was on Rosh Hashanah morning. We got all the kids to come up to blow the shofar with an amazing community shofar blower. And all the kids came up. It was brilliant. We all got them plastic shofar up, you know, COVID safe and everything. But Gabriel, my son, thinks he's the best shofar blower in the world. And that morning it said to me, "So which shofar blasts am I doing?" Which I had not factored in at all, of him like doing a shofar blast, because they don't, it's not, anyway. So I was like, "Well, you can blow it with all the kids. You can have my shofar and all the kids will have their plastic shofar rot." Obviously all the kids come up onto the bimmer, and straight away, "Why has he got that shofar? Why can't I have that one? Why do we have these and he has that one?" And I was like, "Well, he's my son. He just gets favorite treatment." And then I was like, "And that cost me £75. And they were like, "Whoa." This was all happening on the bimmer whilst we were meant to be doing the big moment. But I loved it because it was so like full of joy in kids. And then the kids at the end was like, "And how long's left? Can we go yet?" And it's just really fun because it was like the chaos on the bimmer at Rosh Hashanah. So yeah, really sad because lots of kind of grief about moving, lots of tears and lots of emotions very high, actually, because we feel very connected to our building. It's been, you know, part of our, we've been there since the 50s, but actually it's a strange building. It holds a lot of power over us, really. So a lot of goodbyes, but yeah, I feel really good actually coming out of Simchat Torah and now just getting on with the move and all together. It's good.
Our amazing youth and ed team for Rosh Hashanah created an apple orchard in our youth centre, which was our family service space. And for Yom Kippur, we went under the sea.
Hold on, you can't just say they created an apple orchard. Like, how? What? That sounds amazing.
They hung apples and they created crepe pepper trees. Cool. And we had like little sparkly tree things with baubles on and bees everywhere. And I managed to find an apple dress, which I was very excited about because I love a theme. And just seeing that kind of wonder, really, as people moved into that space. And then we went under the sea for Yom Kippur and they created a little aquarium in one of the windows in the space. It was just very, very, very lovely. So I think a real sense of togetherness really over these days. And that was really amplified on Yom Kippur when sadly my senior rabbi Mark lost his dad at 7 o'clock in the morning on Yom Kippur. I arrived at shul and everyone says, "Have you heard?" I was like, "No, what?"
Oh gosh.
But you know what? Everyone rocked up and did what they could do. And, you know, our warden team stood up and took services, and our, you know, we had volunteers who went and read Torah in the family services where Rabbi Mark was meant to do it. And it, you know, it was a real community sense. I didn't sit down all day, but everyone really got involved. And on a really personal note through that day, my daughter had decided to come to shul with me and just to stay all day with me. And of course, she couldn't be with me most of the day because I'm doing things and on the bimmer. And she's only 10, and she found her way to just sort of finding the people she knew, sitting beautifully, following along. And when she needed a break, she went and did Lego in my office. And just having that sense of, you know, she's starting to really get it was also really, really lovely.
Yeah, I was fascinated. My son, off his own back, decided he needed to fast for the first time this Yom Kippur. And it was really interesting to see that thing of like them choosing their own path, taking on their own Judaism. It's
Eliana toyed with fasting until about 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah. Gabriel made it till breakfast.
There you go.
Great. He really tried, and then he was like, "I'm starving," and ate breakfast at the same time. He always does. That sounds really beautiful, Debbie. I love the idea, like just the togetherness and how people step up in community is always astounding, isn't it? You think if you wrote it, you just think that's going to be a nightmare, and you know that Mark was also supported, Rabbi Mark.
Yeah, and obviously Mark did a huge amount in preparation. We knew it was a possibility, and he had laid everything out ready. You know, we knew where his sermon was, so someone else could pick it up and read it. And when the need is there, people do get involved, and you know, I think the more people can do stuff and know that they're empowered is really wonderful as well.
There is something very beautiful about death and Yom Kippur. You lay yourself so bare and you're so vulnerable as a community on Yom Kippur. We had a very involved member of the community who was in the hospice, and kind of we knew as a community that he and his children were listening on Zoom from the hospice, and sort of he was on the journey with us on Yom Kippur and died the following morning. And there is something extraordinary about how interlinked that sense is of this new year and this, what will this year be like, and knowing that there are some people that kind of won't be taking that step into the new year with us, but was so much part of us arriving at this time. Kind of, I feel there's a sense of kind of being held by them as this year progresses.
Yeah, I think that's, I always take from the High Holy Days, like, it's so spiritually intense. Like, not only is it physically and emotionally exhausting as clergy, but the greatest blessing I find of being clergy is that I can't not do the work. Like, I can't not do the spiritual work. I can't excuse myself and think, actually, I'm a bit tired today. I'm not going to go to shul. I'm whatever. I have to turn up. I have to read almost every single word of the prayers. I have to sing everything. So you become so involved in the spiritual discipline of like that arc from Elul all the way to Simchat Torah. And I'm always amazed at like the release that it helps with in me of kind of going from deep reflection and then into kind of utter joy and abandon in Simchat Torah. And I like last year had a really, really hard High Holy Days because as you both know, and I wrote about online, I went through a miscarriage during the High Holy Days last year. So I think even more so, I kind of understood the festivals in a way last year than I ever had done. It was Rosh Hashanah, it was all good to go. Scans were looking hopeful. Yom Kippur, I was not fasting, but kind of getting into the intensity. And then it was at Sukkot with all the fragility of life, the impermanence of the sukkah that we found out with a 3-month scan. Baby hadn't survived. And then Simchat Torah had my surgery, and the nurse said to me, "What should you have been doing today?" I was like, "Dancing with the Torah." And then I fell asleep or got knocked out. But so like reliving it this year, it was quite intense because of that, because it was quite visceral in a way that it might not have been if it was so attached to the calendar. But again, like the spiritual arc of the festivals was actually really important for me. Like you talk about, you know, death and how the festivals hold us in that. I really felt there was some sort of release or being able to be with it and process it through that time was really powerful. So I do think like the greatest blessing is that I just have to keep turning up to shul, even when I'm not in the mood. It's just so helpful.
And that piece that actually, that reminder that the High Holy Days are different every year, whoever you are, whatever you're going through, that you look out into the world differently. And so the services might be very, very similar every year. The rituals are the same. And yet we experience them so differently. We had a moment on Yom Kippur morning where Melinda Simmons, the British ambassador in Ukraine, was called up for the Aliyat HaTorah, and she'd accepted the mitzvah with her. I might be on Zoom, I might be in person, sort of, you know, it really depends. And it came to the last moments as to whether she would actually be able to get a flight out of Ukraine to be on the Bima on Yom Kippur morning, which she was, which was an extraordinary community moment to be able to have this kind of stark realization of whatever is going on in our lives, that big picture stuff globally and our own personal journeys and the parts that we play, and being able to raise up people who are playing extraordinary roles in community. There is something about that reminder that everything is temporary, and however, whatever we're experiencing, when we're experiencing it, please God, it feels only like a short chapter. And that, you know, the High Holy Days remind us new chapters open, that kind of, as soon as we finished reading Torah, we start again. There's always a starting again. And please God, the starting again will be a positive one.
Yeah. It's really interesting, Robin, you spoke about that sense of the arc of spirituality for yourself. I think quite often as rabbis, it's very easy for our own spirituality or Judaism to somehow be put to the side so that we can facilitate everyone else's to some extent. But I remember our community's emeritus rabbi now, Rabbi Danny Smith, used to, maybe he still does, used to go and spend a day in a nunnery or a monastery dovening the entire liturgy of Yom Kippur over the summer holidays, getting his own sense of what it is to work through those prayers done before he had to do it for everybody else. Do you use your summers to prepare in that way, or do you try and relax and go away and do other things, or is it a bit of both?
My gosh, I love that. So like, that's amazing. I've not heard that before. It's an amazing story. This year, actually, I had 5 weeks off. I had 3 week mini sabbatical and then 2 weeks on holiday. And I used my sabbatical to prepare for the High Holy Days, which I think I'm going to do again. It was brilliant. I never usually do it in that kind of way, but I was in such a good headspace because I was only doing that and then with Gabriel, or, you know, doing whatever. When I was doing it in the summer, in that kind of spaciousness, I was able to connect a bit more, probably in the way that Rabbi Danny did in that way. And then I went to Greece for 2 weeks, all inclusive, and just ate and swam, and it was amazing. And also had the best rabbinic highlight so far of my 5 years, that I did a wedding for a gorgeous couple. Shout out to Charlie and Hannah. I did a wedding in Ibiza, which was amazing. Ibiza's so cool. And the wedding was beautiful. The family and friends were gorgeous. And that was kind of going into the High Holy Day season. So if anyone would like a wedding in Ibiza, I am available the end of next summer. Please do be in touch with producer Dan.
Is he
so
your
my
agent?
Summer was great because of that. I don't know if he can be now, from now on.
I did one about a decade ago in Ibiza. I remember flying out on like some very cheap airline at 5 o'clock in the morning, and everyone else on the flight was not of a sober mind, and I was like, oh my gosh, what is this place that I'm going to? It's going to be insane. And actually, only part of the island is Party Island.
Exactly.
There's like this beautiful nature reserve space, and it's a stunning place.
Yeah, I'm going back. I was completely sold. It's just beautiful. Yeah. How was your summer, Miriam? So yeah, now I've done like the back, like you had Gareth Malone and the ambassador to Ukraine, and I went to Ibiza. So I'm like, now I'm passing it to you.
Right. And it's really interesting. I'd love to say I spent the summer preparing for the High Holy Days, but actually I find so much of it. I knew exactly what I wanted to talk about on Kol Nidre until I'd heard the Rosh Hashanah sermons that my colleagues gave. And then I was like, actually, this is not what I want to say on Kol Nidre, and kind of ended up within the 10 days kind of starting again, like, you know, changing my message for the High Holy Days completely. It's also so live and so in the moment that there's that peace that's around kind of the flexibility. Although we did go away much, much earlier in the summer than we normally do. And I would really love to have learnt over the 2 years of COVID where we didn't travel at all for 2.5 years, that we didn't need to leave the country. But actually, I didn't. I did quite the opposite and realized that there was something about being in the same time zone throughout that for basically 3 years that I didn't switch off. I didn't stop. And even when we were away for the summers that we were able to be, it felt like I could nip back. It felt too close. It felt too, I was too present. And we had a couple of weeks in Canada, which was just wonderful and felt like the first real kind of family time. And the three of us had a really, really lovely time. We were traveling constantly around Canada. We only spent like 2 nights in any one place. But what an amazing country. And what I learned was everyone should be more Canadian. They're just such nice people. So real, so authentic, so warm, so kind. If the world was a little bit more Canadian, I think it would be a better place.
Mm. It's like that in Manchester, by the way. It's just because you live in London.
Fair enough.
But Canada is, I'm also a big fan of Canada. Yeah.
I think it also takes time to switch off.
I'm always incredibly, incredibly grumpy the first day we're away and the day before we go. I find the transition, because there's just something that's really odd about the shift of perspective.
I think it also comes from genuinely caring. So like, I genuinely care about the members of my community. I'm not just like rocking up to a hospital or making that phone call because I'm paid to, because I'm the rabbi. I genuinely care about my members. And therefore, I sometimes feel like, well, am I deserting everybody? Am I just leaving? And so there's that getting out of that headspace as well and saying, you know, it is okay.
And actually, if we don't have that downtime and that switch off, then we can't continue.
And I have amazing colleagues. Everyone. Like, it's not like I'm really deserting anybody. They're in fabulous hands with a wonderful team. Mm-hmm. It's about me and my need rather than anybody else's. Debbie, what about your summer? Were you preparing for the High Holy Days, or did you actually get a break?
I did get a break. We had our first trip abroad since pre-COVID. We went to Spain for 10 days. I think I need to get better at holidaying. I don't think I'm very good at it. It was not the rest that I hoped it to be. Although, you know, there were lovely moments. I think it's now our top skill is messing up going to the beach. Gary, my husband, found this gorgeous beach that was an hour and a half away. We were on the Costa del Sol, so there are lots of beaches. He found one an hour and a half away that's like the perfect beach. So we drove for an hour and a half to this perfect beach, and we left in glorious sunshine, and when we got there it was drizzling and windy. We're just like, what is going on? So we sat on the beach for about an hour, and then the sun came out and we had our sandy lunch, and after about an hour and a half, 2 hours, I was like, it's too windy, the sea's not fun, let's go back. And then another day we went to a beach that was much closer, and it was so windy our parasol kept flying away and trying to decapitate people. So kind of sitting there huddling, holding onto our umbrella. It was very Brits on holiday. It was terrible.
I did a teaching session for the staff of Anthony Nolan, big shout out to the life-saving charity that they run, and was teaching about Tishri festivals, why so many of their Jewish colleagues were off work for so many days, and was talking about Sukkot. And one of the people that worked there was talking about his love of camping, and how when you look up at the stars in the way that I was talking about being able to through the roof of the sukkah, he was talking about that, you know, as coming from a non-religious background, that thing of sitting outside when the nights that you're camping, that you can't fail to connect with something bigger. And even if you don't have religious language for it, there's something about being outside in a area of the world that's not got all the light pollution of nearest cities, and actually being able to look up and see the stars, and you acknowledge that you are but dust and ashes kind of thing. And so it was an interesting insight into.
And I think the freedom that our certainly as families, the freedom you can give your kids when you're camping is so precious, because actually there's a lot of rigidity in our world for them and a lot of routines and rules and uniforms. And, you know, on a campsite, I'm generally quite happy for them to just go off, find the playground, do their thing.
Meet other kids.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm nodding away. I've like never camped as a family. I'm like,
come
nodding
with
and I'm
us.
Like,
we should have a rabbiting on
hotels.
Camp. Miriam in her heels.
No, but hotels are lovely because you don't have to do anything. And it's like so nice not to have to cook. And you get a posh bathroom, a lovely comfy bed. Like,
so
that's what
and,
I love about
and,
going away.
I think I'm an and in this moment, because we go away with the same three other families once a year glamping. And there's nothing more relaxing in the kids just being able to entertain themselves. I'm yet to find a hotel that would give you that freedom where the kids can just be themselves and you're not worried about anybody else, you know, disturbing anybody else. And it doesn't matter how late it is. And there is something amazing about sitting around a campfire, making s'mores and singing and having your guitars out. I love it.
And breakfast
hotel
outside.
Breakfast,
and nothing
there's
like
nothing
it.
Better than hotel breakfast.
You, well, I don't you know. Don't I think breakfast cooked on a outdoor stove in the, you know, still in your pyjamas. I love it.
Hotel buffet breakfast.
Did either of you have any mad holiday disasters, or was it all plain sailing?
It's never plain sailing, is it? Like family holidays. And that's part of the fun of it, I think. Ours was relatively plain sailing, apart from Gabriel got a vomiting bug on the day of travel on the way back. So I was like queuing. Anthony had to keep running back to the toilet with him. Gabriel had a really hard trip back. It was really gross and horrible for him. But what was funny was we went to this very nice hotel and it's like all inclusive and everything. And we were like, oh, we could go back there because it was very easy and it was really like fun. And Gabriel's like, I got food poisoning. I shall not be going back to that place. You're like, that's what you're taking away from 10 days in a beautiful hotel. But he was convinced that was, you know,
it was
and
there.
It wasn't. He didn't get food poisoning. He just got a bit of a bug or whatever. But all family holidays, always, you know, arguments, aren't there? Because you're getting stuff out of your system, I think. I think it's quite
oh, thank God, it's
important.
Not
oh, no, all the time. But I think it's you have to play these things out, like you say, and then you kind of settle into it and you find a different way of being. That's always flavoured throughout it. And also, I love being at the airport. And you see all the other families bickering with each other and being rude to each other. And Anthony and I always turn around and go, okay, let's try harder with each other. Because when you see it within other people, you always think, oh, it looks really ugly. Like it doesn't. And you know you do it.
Our first argument at Gatwick was that they had a room of prayer and Gary hadn't done Shacharit yet, hadn't done morning prayers. But the room of prayer was before security. And we all know that security has been a nightmare this time. So I'm like, no, you are not going in that room of prayer. You are coming through security. And this poor boy, all he wanted to do was get him put his tefillin on.
We always tell the same story when we're at any airport now. We have to tell the muffin story because it reminds us of those families and not to be that family, right? Very, very early in a fast food outlet trying to buy some coffee and kind of breakfast, and mother and child in front. Child crying and going, but you said I could have a muffin. And the mum's going, I've got you a muffin. I wanted a muffin. There's your muffin. I've got you a muffin. I wanted a muffin. And the mum's going, I've got you a muffin. The mum's screaming expletives at this poor child who's crying more and more, going, I just wanted a muffin. And there's just this piece of me, like, at what point do I then go, I think she means a chocolate muffin and you're talking about a breakfast egg muffin. They're really different. I really didn't want to be on the end of the wrath of this scary woman who I was terrified on behalf of the child. But the child did not have the language to say, you've called this a muffin, but it doesn't look like she wanted a cake. It was very funny. So we always tell that story as if to be like, however early it is and however tetchy one is at the airport, never turn into the muffin mum, because we all have tendencies to become that person.
Oh, I've been that person. Yeah, exactly. It's why it's when you see it mirrored to you, right. That's what actually my Yom Kippur sermon was all about.
Muffins?
Nidre sermon was all about that. It was not about muffins, but it was about the muffin lady, actually. Like, as it turns out, all about anger and like that evil inclination of like how easy it is to step into it. And it's because a congregant had said to me in the summer, anger is easier than grief. And I thought, so powerful. There's something like anger is easier to go to than actually dealing with the reality of we're all a bit tired. It's like hard work. Let's turn to compassion or whatever it is, like, you know, going down to their level. what do you mean? Let's talk it through type thing or whatever it is.
That's really interesting. My Yom Kippur sermon last year was about anger.
There's a lot of
and
it
forgiveness
about
as well. This year I went for basically people are complicated and it's never as simple as we think. And I while I was on holiday, I read Sandy Toksvig's book about her father's life in Denmark during the Second World War. He was a young boy. It's actually written really for kind of tweens and teens. It's a beautiful book. I'd really recommend it. Really easy read. Denmark rescued like 98% of their Jewish community. It's this incredible story of heroism. But Sandy Toksvig keeps saying in the book, you know, not all the Danes did the right thing. Not all the Danes were good. And actually a lot of the German soldiers assisted us and didn't check properly and weren't all bad people. And this kind of sense of how complicated life is. And then on the way out after Conradre, we try and get to the door to say goodbye to everyone and meet with people. Three different congregants told me that their families were saved by those Danish boats. And it was so moving. I hadn't expected that at all. But yeah, my Yom Kippur takeaway was, from my sermon at least, was people are complicated.
You never know the inner world.
How about you, Miriam? What's your one line takeaway?
Really about hope and about relationships, and that it's that those interactions between people that give us that sense of hope and an acknowledgement that it will get easier. We each give a sermon over the High Holy Days. I know those people who have to give like five hate our big teams where we each only need to give one. But basically, we only speak once kind of properly over the High Holy Days. And it turned out that both the Rosh Hashanah morning sermons were pretty hardcore, kind of depressing, isn't the world in a terrible place? And I had thought about, and I was going to be talking about fear. And I was like, oh, actually, I need to twist that and change and pivot. And had ended up having an incredibly moving conversation with the daughter of the member in the hospice when I had gone to visit between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And actually, you know, it's amazing where we take that inspiration from. But that bedside conversation allowed me to sort of pivot the sermon into a more hopeful space.
Well, that is almost it for today. But before we go, we really, really want to thank the powers that be at the Reform Judaism Movement Towers. They're having us back for this second round of Rabbiting On. And we're just really, really grateful that they've given us the opportunity to continue and that we've got your attention, that you're here with us listening and joining the conversation, we hope. So thank you for joining us if you've made it this far.
While you're talking about RJ, Debbie, can I put in a plug for the Honeycomb Project?
Please.
It's an extraordinary way of being able to volunteer in your community, but also feel that you've been tooled up with some really important skills. Some of the pastoral work you might think can only be done by clergy, but actually that relationship between member to member and being able to hold and support and really listen to people is something that can be done, I'm sure, by anyone with the right training and with the right insights. So there's still a few spaces on that course. It's joint with the Reform and Liberal movements and is a wonderful course of training. Begins on the 2nd of November. And if you want more information, you can go to reformjudaism.org/honeycomb.
And hopefully there'll be a link in the show notes as well for anyone who wants to find out more about that. As ever, MRJ is busy behind the scenes, quietly and efficiently working to bring us all together as different communities with all our different approaches, supporting our youth and ensuring that where it counts, our values are being represented and heard. But all this this praise and joking aside, we also really want to thank our production team who are out there ready to respond to all of your emails and texts. So please feel free to send them your innermost thoughts or just a hello. We love hearing from you. Let us know what you'd like out of this second round of Rabbiting On.
And when can people start booking tickets for our live show at JW3?
Oh, yeah.
It's a great question. I'm sure we will let them know when booking opens, but you can email our producers and get through to us via media@rjuk.org, or you can text and WhatsApp. I hope you've got your phones ready to get the number down. It's +44, which is for the benefit of our international listeners. We do have some of those too. So +44 7922 575 583. I don't know that responses will be instantaneous because people do have to rest and sleep, but do get in touch. And hopefully in the next few weeks, we will be able to tell you exactly how you can not only listen, but be present with the conversation when we go to JW3 begin the reach of our tentacles across the global media empire that Rabbiting On has its sights set on.
Please turn up.
But we will be back in a couple of weeks with lots more chat, as well as that news on how to book for JW3. And it's just so lovely being back with Rabbi Miriam and Rabbi Robin and with all of you. And we hope to see you soon.
Lovely to chat to you.
Bye.
Bye.
That was fun. I enjoyed that conversation.